Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon and welcome to FedSoc Forums. I'm Alex Zenos, Practice Groups Fellow at the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of Trump v. Barbara, decided yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us, we have Professor Kurt T. Lash, E. Claiborne Robbins Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, Professor Ilan Werman of the University of Minnesota Law School, and Eric Wesson, Solicitor General of Iowa. A couple of notes before we begin. As always, the Federal Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Towards the end of the program, time permitting, we'll take questions from the audience. So if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen. And with that, I will turn things over to our speakers to start today's conversation.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you to the Federalist Society for having us. This is obviously an important case. I'm just appreciative that the Supreme Court decided to issue such a clear and concise opinion, making it easy for everyone to review on such an expedited basis. Before we all dig in, I just wanted to take a few moments to cover some of the basics of this case for those of you in the audience that aren't following it that closely, or even for those of you that are, just to set the stage. So the case is Trump v. Barbara. This is the second time a challenge to President Trump's executive order has been heard at the Supreme Court. The first time in the Trump v. Casa case, the focus was on scope of relief. And a kind of funny twist, it turns out the scope of relief didn't really matter. On remand, the district courts re-entered the same scope of relief, and this time the focus was really just on the merits. And the merits asked whether Trump's executive order 14160, which said that starting from 30 days after the entry of the executive order, that certain groups of people in the United States, mostly illegal aliens and people in the country temporarily, their children would not be U.S. citizens. That was a shift from what had been practice at the very least for the past 70 or so years, whereby anyone born in the United States outside of three categories that I'm sure we'll talk about were automatically citizens here. The vote was at the top line, a 6-3 holding that the executive order was invalid. But really, it was more of a 5-1 and then 4 varying dissents type opinion. The majority by Chief Justice Roberts focused on the constitutional issue and said that the 14th Amendment, whose text talks about children, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And he found that under that constitutional section, that anyone born here, basically outside of the three categories to be discussed, which are Indians, children of diplomats, and invading armies, are citizens. And of course, with Indians, there was a statutory change later. Justice Kavanaugh wrote a separate concurrence, basically saying that he would decide this on statutory rather than constitutional grounds, and implying on the constitutional grounds that he actually disagreed with the holding of the majority. Well, he said he disagreed, he dissented from that, but said that he would go further, perhaps even than some of the dissenters, in narrowing the scope of who must be a citizen if born here under the Constitution. Justices Jackson, joined mostly by Justice Sotomayor, wrote a concurrence expanding on the chief's majority. And then Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Gorsuch, dissented, and Justice Alito dissented separately. And those dissents focused on their disagreements with the majority. I don't know, I haven't fact checked this, but a learned law professor I spoke to yesterday said he believed that this was Justice Thomas's longest single writing, more than 90 pages. It's almost like a short book. But anyway, I just wanted to lay the groundwork of what had transpired The reason that I think I was invited here is Iowa co-led an amicus brief with Tennessee on behalf of 25 states supporting the administration's policy and the legality of the executive order. Just in case you're wondering why some random Iowa lawyer is on this panel. And I will just note, because I can't help myself, that like my colleagues here, our writing in this case was cited by Justice Thomas in the dissent. I think everyone participating in this panel was cited in at least one of the various opinions. For me, it's a first. So that's pretty neat. But Alon, I'll turn it over to you next to give your perspective on this case. Maybe just lay out some of your opening thoughts, and then we can get into some of the more interesting questions. And then when you're done, pass it over to Professor Lash.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me here. Obviously, some top level reaction is that we've come a long way from the year and a half ago. This was going to be 9-0 after oral argument. I think we were like 8-1, 7-2. I was actually at the DC Circuit Judicial Conference, and a very accomplished lawyer asked me, so, you know, how's the case going to come down? I'm like, I don't know, maybe 6-3. And the question was, who's gonna join Thomas and Alito? You know, like, and I was like, I don't know, you know, maybe not, maybe it will be 8-1, you know, so even just like a week ago. But it turned out to be 5-4, right, on the constitutional question, which I think is a testament to people like Kurt Lash and others who, including myself, you know, who've come out since the executive order and said, hey, you know what, like the conventional wisdom is not actually as open and shut as everybody thinks. And so I think it's important that you know, to have this sort of legal scholarship in the works. And let me give some high, there's just so many things one could say and react to on the fly. The New Digest just posted an article that this is the death of originalism. And like, I don't know, maybe, but I think everyone was arguing in an originalist spirit. I think everybody was trying to get it right. And you know, originalism does not inevitably and invariably lead to one result in any particular case. It is just more constrained than alternatives, but more fundamentally, it's just a theory of where law comes from. So I don't know. I think it's a success in a sense for originalism. Now, let me just do a high level comment on sort of the majority opinion. And then actually, let me very, very briefly survey the options on the table. So Justice Kavanaugh had the narrowest view on the constitutional question. He seemed to suggest that citizens, a child born only of citizens would be a citizen. He doesn't unpack that. He doesn't go much into detail about it, because you can tell he kind of doesn't want to, right? He's like, this is a statutory, like, why can't we resolve this on the statutory question? So I found that interesting. Alito had a slightly narrower, less narrow view, but still pretty narrow, which is the subject of the jurisdiction basically covers the Civil Rights Act, right? It means the same thing, subject, not subject to any foreign power. So at the very end of his opinion, he goes through like if Mexico treats a child born here of Mexican parents as a national citizen with obligations of citizenship, they're out because they are subject to a foreign power. So not quite as narrow as Kavanaugh's intuition, but pretty narrow. The principal dissent, Thomas and Gorsuch, took the view that it's domicile, which is my view for whatever it's worth, closest to my view. And then the majority, as you said, Eric, you know, everybody with the exception of some common law exceptions. I will say, the one sort of disappointing part of the majority opinion that they didn't really confront with, you know, so as I've said before, Justice Barrett was clearly asking the right questions at oral argument. Like, she was trying to find that through line, right, to like what connects ambassadors and Indian tribes and invading soldiers. And the majority settled on extraterritoriality, this fiction of extraterritoriality for ambassadors, this idea that soldiers are in occupied territory are extraterritorial. I mean, it's kind of weird even saying it. And the Indian tribes are extraterritorial. But there's a lot of counter evidence that they just really didn't confront. So like Sir Edward Cook from Calvin's case, which they cite a lot, described foreign soldiers occupying a town as being upon the king's soil. It's not extraterritorial, right? What about their children? What about the children of the loyal citizens born in the occupied town, right? Sir Edward Cook says the children of the invaders are not citizens. It doesn't say anything about them. Justice Thomas and Gorsuch have tons and tons of evidence that the Indian tribes were thought to be on U.S. territory and in U.S. jurisdiction, that it was not extraterritorial, right? There's no fiction of extraterritoriality in the common law sources with respect to ambassadors, right? So it was is a pretty weak through line. That was a little bit disappointing. On the ultimate holding, they said, so I just said the exemptions. Well, what is the rule that the majority says from which, you know, these are exempt the because of extraterritoriality? The rule is if you're subject to law, right, subject to U.S. law, subject to a governing power. But this is a bit awkward because they don't mention the General Crimes Act of 1817, which, you know, subjected Indian tribes to some degree of U.S. criminal jurisdiction. And there are many other examples of that in the dissents that they really don't confront. So it's a bit awkward. But again, I think an earnest attempt to do originalism, I think. I was a bit more, I don't know, I said maybe politics had more to do with it when I was doing our podcast that we dropped this morning of our podcast, the Rationally Based podcast. But now I'm like, no, I don't know. I do think they were genuinely trying to get it right. As for the domicile point, let me just say one last thing about this and then I'll stop. I think it's generally correct. Of course, I've written something similar. If it's not subject to U.S. law, what is subject to the jurisdiction mean? And they told us, and Kurt Lash has uncovered a lot of this as well. They said a complete jurisdiction, legislative, executive, and judicial. How does that connect to domicile? In the following sense, there may be several reasons why certain categories of people are not subject to the complete jurisdiction of the United States. Ambassadors under the law of nations were not subject to that jurisdiction. Indian tribes were domestic dependent nation. Foreign invaders were subject to international law, the law of war, military law, right? Not to the municipal law. And that has nothing to do with domicile. That's just other international law exemptions from this complete jurisdiction. But domicile generally confer a complete jurisdiction over aliens. And that was the really best part, I think, of the Thomas Gorsuch opinion, where they go through several examples where domicile related to jurisdiction. You can't conscript temporary visitors. You can't tax in the same way temporary visitors. You cannot exercise a general judicial jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over temporary visitors. The United States owes protection abroad to domiciled foreigners as well as its own citizens, right? So they show in ways in which a complete jurisdiction is lacking for those who lack a domicile. Much more I could say. Those are really top level, high level thoughts to begin with. I will say Kurt Lash was cited 9 times. Really congratulations to him. Again, I think our perspective is we both, you know, if we're going to lose, 5-4 is the way to do it, I guess, on the constitutional question. But Kurt, what are your sort of top level reactions?
Great summary. The opinions, Elon and Eric, thank you for moderating here. A lot of people, you know, before I dig into the opinions, a lot of people have done, you know, really important scholarly work in the face of some pretty radically awful accusations, public accusations, and attempts to shame them out of the public debate. So there are a lot of people who I think deserve a lot of respect. Amy Swear, in particular, who also was cited in the opinions, has done really good work, and I think her work on conscription, you can see that in a number of the dissents. But lots of people have been working on this for some time, and certainly Elon has gotten his share of flack. So good for those who fought the good fight and brought the historical evidence to the table. And I think that over time, it made a difference. I think when this debate first started, it was all, oh, the text is clear. It means what it says. And somehow that meant that Trump's executive order was manifestly unconstitutional. People didn't know the history at that point. And it's been over a series of months that really substantial scholarship has forced its way, despite the headwinds, forced its way into the public consciousness and ultimately convinced 4 justices on the Supreme Court to go in a direction that clearly what they were seeing in the media and in the loudest public voices they're being told was absolutely outrageous. So I'm very pleased. I think it shows the effectiveness of scholarship to make a difference with the court. If we just have enough time and we just have the ability to get those arguments before before the court. And I personally believe if we'd had more time, if this had gone on another 6 months, maybe if oral arguments had been heard in the fall, I think it would have been very, very difficult for justices like Justice Barrett to sign on to an opinion that so clearly did not grapple with the historical arguments at all. And I think it would have been much more likely to have five justices ruling on the statutory grounds, which I think is far more plausible. Now, in terms of the actual opinions, again, you have the majority opinion, which it believes is based on a common law rule that was announced in Wong Kim Ark. And as Elon, I think very correctly just described, the common law rule focuses on the word jurisdiction. And they believe that the common law and legal treatises, antebellum treatises, look at jurisdiction as simply involving an exercise of government power over the individual. And so as far as the majority is concerned, government power, you're subject to the laws and you're subject to the authority of the United States, whether you're here temporarily or not, and whether or not you are here legally or not. So that was enough for them. They don't do any heavy lifting whatsoever. They don't cite any scholarship. They make a lot of historical assertions without any citation whatsoever. And I think what that indicates is they simply reverse engineered Wong Kim Ark. Their analysis of history pretty much sticks to the same treatises and cases that were cited in Wong Kim Ark. So the beginning of their opinion walks through Lynch v. Clark and Calvin's case and all the rest of them. And then by the time they make their way up to Wong Kim Ark, they say, see, Wong Kim Ark cites all the things that we just cited in our prior opinion. So they simply wanted to uphold a broad reading of Wong Kim Ark and weren't interested in investigating any counter evidence that existed historically. The other justices engaged in history. Now, maybe the reason why some people say this is the death of originalism is because you have two very important justices who sometimes are interested in history, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett, joining three members of the court who are obviously anti-originalist. And those are very powerful votes, and they controlled this particular outcome. But the fact that I think that you have very four important justices on the court who engage the history, I think it speaks very well. And it speaks very well of the advance of historical argument and originalist argument. So you get to Kavanaugh, and Kavanaugh just states, listen, I'm not sure. I don't think that President Trump had the authority to issue the executive order. I think that Congress controls this particular area. So he's very deferential to the legislative process. And he just comes out and said that the majority is wrong on the 14th Amendment. They do not have a plausible historical account of the meaning of those texts. Then you get into the extraordinary deep dive into history by Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Gorsuch. As Elon just said, basically looking for finding a domicile requirement at common law, which they believed also was maintained at the time of the 14th Amendment and continued to inform citizenship law, natural born citizenship law, after the ratification of the 14th Amendment. Then a rather elegant opinion, also based on history. I'm going to call it elegant because it's the opinion I actually think got it right. A shorter opinion by Justice Alito focuses on, he believes that you have an allegiance. The way we should understand subject to jurisdiction is by persons born in a manner having sole allegiance to the United States and not holding any allegiance to any foreign government. And and he bases this on the text. He does he chides the majority for focusing on the word jurisdiction. What they should have been focusing on is the phrase subject to the jurisdiction, and he points out that if they had been attentive to the phrase, they would have noticed immediately that it couldn't mean simply being within the jurisdiction of the United States, because the text of the Equal Protection Clause uses that language just a couple of sentences later. So clearly, subject to jurisdiction must mean something different, and provides a historical evidence that subject to jurisdiction had to be had to do with being in a position of sufficient allegiance. He then says, "I know we shouldn't overly rely on legislative debates, on legislative history," and he claims to base his opinion on text and historical context of the text. And I think he does a good job, but he couldn't help himself from saying, "But if we're going to look at the legislative debates, Lyman Trumbull and the key framers told us expressly what is subject to jurisdiction in the United States mean. It means allegiance to the United States and no other foreign government." It's kind of a rough paraphrase, and he puts that in bold, right? And he's right to do so, because the framers expressly addressed their understanding of the text, and it's completely missing from the majority opinion, which I really think is outrageous. There is clear express counter evidence in the historical record. It doesn't mean you have to be persuaded by it. Maybe you're not. But to leave out the framers' own definition and understanding of their handiwork, I think is not a good move for the majority.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. I do want to leave a little time for questions. We've got 45 total minutes and we're 23 minutes in, so I'm going to try to keep this tight. I guess a couple big questions that stand out to me that I think people would be interested in. We've got these three categories from Juan Kimark. Are either of you satisfied that now we know where they came from? And in the alternative, as you talk about that, do you think that those three categories are now constitutionally frozen in amber, so to speak, that the majority opinion has just said that those are the only three exclusions that could exist? And Professor Lash, maybe we'll start with you on this one.
Well, Justice Alito addresses that very point, and I agree with Justice Alito that they haven't frozen those categories in amber. They actually did describe a principle, and Elon talked about this just a second ago. The court doesn't say just these three categories and nothing else. They describe those categories as reflecting this principle of extraterritoriality. And according to Alito, there's nothing in the majority opinion, and certainly nothing in the text or in history, that suggests that principle describes in a bespoke manner these specific three categories. You certainly can't derive those three categories or even the word extraterritoriality from the text of the 14th Amendment itself. So Alito, and maybe Kavanaugh, Elon, maybe you can remind me, Kavanaugh might have raised this point as well. It's still possible that that principle could be defined. And I think Kavanaugh did say that Congress could define that principle and have it apply to categories that might not have been in the minds of the framers or the people who adopted the 14th Amendment. They knew certain categories that fit that description, but that doesn't mean others might couldn't arise in the future.
Yes. So this is really interesting. I mean, like the first thing to point out is, as Justice Kavanaugh says, like where else in constitutional interpretation do we just like freeze exceptions in time? The closest I could think of is the First Amendment, where they have the categorical exemptions, but even then it's only a partial account of the doctrine, right? Because they do allow restrictions beyond the categorical exemptions, you know, based on interest balancing or whatever. Second Amendment cases, even under Bruin, it's you don't need historical twins of regulations; they just have to be analogous. So when is it like precisely carved in stone, which is weird? But putting aside the problem with the historical evidence for the extraterritorial view, I believe this was in the Thomas and Gorsuch opinion. Did you know that, or a version of this, this specific point wasn't in there, but did you know that if an immigrant or if a migrant is arriving at the border and they are detained, they, under congressional law, are treated as not being in the United States for various purposes? Does it follow if they killed the border guard, you can't criminally prosecute them? That would be preposterous. So if this is true, what's to stop Congress from passing a law saying general purposes, anybody here illegally shall be deemed not to be within the United States. However, we subject them to criminal process. And if the Supreme Court then comes back and says, well, you subject them to criminal process, and that's all that matters. Okay, then that means anybody arriving at the border and detained instantly is within the United States for the relevant purposes, because obviously we could subject them to criminal process. And I just don't think the court would be prepared to say that it's unconstitutional for Congress to treat all of them as not being within the United States, right? So it's super weird. Even if extraterritoriality is the through line, why couldn't Congress deem individuals coming here, just like they deem migrants who evade inspection at the border to be applicants for admission? Why can't they deem them to be outside the United States for most relevant purposes? And, you know, Eric, you know, you tweeted about this or posted on X, excuse me. There were decisions in the early 20th century. There was a case where World War I had broken out. And so an inadmissible alien was released into the United States on the sort of humanitarian parole. And the law said that you're not within the United States for relevant purposes if you're released on parole. And the individual claimed citizenship based on the naturalization statutes because her father had naturalized and therefore she should claim it. And the court said, no, for purposes of the immigration laws, Congress can deem you not to be residing in the United States for purposes of, you know, the naturalization. And so again, even if the extraterritorial line is true, would it really disable Congress? I don't know. I just feel like they've opened up a huge can of worms here, and we just don't know. We just don't know.
Yeah, in that case, Kaplan v. Todd was cited in a footnote in Thomas's dissent, but otherwise went unremarked upon throughout the opinions. And it did, I mean, to me, it seemed like these opinions were, besides the specific moments of clash where they maybe poked at the others, a little bit ships passing in the night. There were different methodological and theoretical underpinnings that led each of the decisions from their different starting points to very different conclusions. And that can be less satisfying than an opinion where you really have clash and you have people that are methodologically similar coming to different results. And perhaps that would have been had Justice Barrett written what she would have done. But alas, we don't know what she would have written. Now, one question, and this comes from the Q&As, but modified a touch. I think a lot of people that were interested in this executive order had convinced themselves that it was likely that the result was going to be a statutory ruling rather than a constitutional ruling. Part of that was probably a little hopium, right? They thought that the door could be left ajar. But part of that is that Chief Justice Roberts has a reputation for choosing to issue narrow rulings rather than broad ones. And the constitutional ruling prescribes more than the statutory would have. So Alon, maybe starting with you, were you surprised that it was a reach for the constitutional issue? And maybe as a, you know, a partner, an unfair question, I think, you know, people thought this opinion could have been 9-0 going one way. Would you rather have had it been a 9-0 or a 7-2 statutory decision or the 5-4 constitutional decision that maybe constrains more what can be done afterwards?
Definitely statutory. I just think it would have been better and easier. But if they were going to remark on the constitutional question, I'm at least, you know, glad that four acknowledged that there is competing interpretations here and that are equally plausible. On the statutory approach. So originally, I was of the view that they wouldn't do the statutory approach. And that's because it's actually difficult to reach the statutory approach because the statute parrots back the language, right, of the 14th Amendment subject to the jurisdiction. And they don't like doing legislative history. So how do you know what the Congress in the 1940s and 50s, when they enacted and reenacted versions of the Immigration and Nationality Act that use this language, how do you know that they had this broad view, right, of birthright citizenship? There's like a statement from a member of Congress that the briefs talked about and that the Second Circuit opinion talked about, or First Circuit opinion talked about. But like, we don't like doing legislative history, right? So I thought it would be very difficult, certainly not plumbing the depths of legislative history, like one sentence about like, yeah, everyone born or whatever, wouldn't quite cut it. So I thought they wouldn't reach a statutory issue because it's difficult to mind read in the 40s and 50s. Right. Having said that, Kavanaugh came up with a really clever approach, which I don't know if it's right exactly, but it was very clever. He said, look, I'm going to embrace the broad reading of Juan Kemark from the majority. And I'm going to suppose that that broad reading of Juan Kemark took hold in the public discourse, if not immediately, because it's compelled by Juan Kemark. I'm actually giving, I think, a slightly better version of the argument. Certainly by the 1920s and 30s, this broad reading took hold, and you can figure this out by all sorts of extrinsic evidence. And therefore, it is highly unlikely that the members of Congress that enacted the INA in the 1940s and 50s did not ratify the broadly accepted understanding of the Juan Kemark decision. Now, look, I'm not sure he's right about Juan Kemark and how broad it was and how quickly it was interpreted broadly, but the majority clearly interprets Juan Kemark the same way, right? And so that's where I'm confused about, because I thought it was difficult to get to the statutory argument because I don't think Juan Kemark says what the majority says it does. I don't think it was interpreted the way the majority says it does. But if it was, then what's wrong with Kavanaugh's statutory argument that Congress therefore ratified that view, and we're not going to touch the question of whether that view was correct or compelled as a constitutional matter? So I initially thought, just to summarize, that it was not a good approach, that it'd be difficult to get there. But Kavanaugh, quite masterfully actually, uses the majority's own interpretation of Juan Kemark to say, well, if that's true, we can get to this on statutory grounds. That would have been a statesman-like opinion. Right? So, like, and everybody thinks Chief Justice Roberts cares about the institution. And now maybe Chief Justice Roberts' perspective was that he was being an institutionalist because, you know, some things are just too much for us to bear. This has been the conventional wisdom for a long time. The president's exceeding authority, have to rule against Trump occasionally. I don't know. But it strikes me that Kavanaugh's approach was clever and works with the majority's view. So I'm surprised they didn't go that route.
So, Kurt, to unfairly change the question a little bit.
Oh, God. Okay.
So I think Ilan just covered a little bit about the statute and just thinking about what comes next now. So the big discussion is, this is a 5-4 constitutional ruling. Does this end the conversation until there's a change in personnel? Are there, whether it's an executive order limiting birthright citizenship on U.S. territories, Congress passing a declaration of war relating to the southern border and designating the people coming across the border as invaders? Are there creative ways that either the president or Congress could take the majority's ruling and say, okay, within those constraints, we understand a constitutional amendment isn't going to happen, but there are things that we can do. Do you think the outcome would change, maybe the easy, maybe hard version of the question, if Congress just passed a law that was just like the executive order today, and that law was challenged? Do you think this case would come out the same way?
Well, these are political prediction questions, and obviously not my wheelhouse.
I'm not asking whether this will happen. I'm asking if you think any of those types of actions could fit within the majority's holding. Like, are these actions that you think reading the majority, because I guess my read of the majority opinion is this is very broad. And so the question is do you think there will continue to be percolation among the political branches that could comport with that majority opinion or not?
Okay. I'll take it. You know, I'll field the ball, you know, hit towards me. I think there, first of all, Congress can just jump on extraterritoriality and work with that. I think that Elon is right that they have Section 5 power to enforce the citizenship clause and also immigration and naturalization power and things along those lines. Heck, their commerce powers and international commerce powers, lots of things that they can do that would force issues about what it means to be born in the United States. And we could certainly, there would be room for them to define that and say that we accept the reasoning of the Supreme Court, but there's lots that hasn't been talked about. And certainly the court, you know, did not address or in any way limit our ability to enforce our understanding of this extraterritoriality principle. So they could try to avoid a Bernie question about trying to change the court's actual interpretation of the rule. But I think it has to be the place to politically draft constitutional legislation is going to be at that, what is it, that liminal area, that place where you may or may not be in the United States. In terms of a declaration of war power, I don't know. I'm going to give that one to Elon. It's a question of, obviously it turns into a question of political will. But I really do just want to briefly expand upon what Elon just said. Kavanaugh's opinion, and I think Elon's right, what Elon just said, Kavanaugh's opinion, I think, exposes the majority as really being a constitutionally problematic decision in all kinds of ways. The Chief Justice has talked about expressly in other situations that if you can avoid the constitutional issue, you avoid the constitutional issue. And he knew that he was dealing with a case where the court was radically split, right? This wasn't some outlier justice clinging to some type of crazy idea. You had as close a split on the court and a disagreement about history that you could possibly get. Kavanaugh's opinion shows that there were 5 votes to invalidate the executive order on the basis of a reading of the statute that embraced a broad reading of Wong Kim Ark. And so there really is no constitutionally ethical reason for the court to have simply jumped to the 14th Amendment. And it raises lots of questions as to why they did it when it clearly wasn't necessary and when it went against what the Chief Justice has claimed were important constitutional prudential rules in past cases.
So just because we've got 5 minutes left, and I actually think this is a very important meta question about the whole context of the case. And I want to start with you, Professor Lash. This decision was 5-4 on the constitutional issue, and I'm going to state as a non-scholar that I think one of the major reasons that it was so close is because there has been so much scholarship exploring the contours of what this citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment means. But we have seen to me appears to be an almost unprecedented backlash in the academy to the truth-seeking function of law professors in good faith exploring important constitutional questions. And so, Professor Lash, I just want you to talk a little bit about your perspective on that and whether you think that kind of, I mean, I'm seeing, you know, posts on blue sky, blue screen, whatever you want to call it today, of like repercussions for, you know, publishing research papers.
Right.
What do you think about that When I was at University of Chicago Law School, I don't think we had a single professor that self-ID'd as conservative. So I imagine that it would probably be a tough atmosphere to do this kind of research. There's my opening. I would just be interested in your thoughts about all of that and what can be done to make sure that when these important questions come up, that the academy can't just shut down or try to shut down folks they disagree with. And Professor Werman, I'm going to want you to answer that one too.
Well, I think, it's a very important question. It's one of the questions that we're going to have to continue to talk about. And just to make sure that the truth-seeking function of academia can continue, because there was an extraordinary outpouring of vitriol and accusations of bad faith and jockeying for position in the Trump administration, just all kinds of assaults on academics like Elon and myself and others. Simply because we were questioning what was a consensus among the left, I suppose, the majority of academics, that Trump's executive order was unconstitutional. What should have happened was simply a debate and merits on merits. And if there's a countered historical argument, make the counter historical argument. Instead, it was a condemnation of there being a debate at all. Condemnation of the New York Times for publishing editorials. An actual threat leveled at the students at Notre Dame, that they were going to be made to regret publishing my piece, for example, on the citizenship clause. And yes, it's primarily on Blue Sky, but I think it was pervasive in the academy that there was going to be a social cost and maybe a career cost to any young academic who wanted to investigate the actual historical evidence and let it lead where it goes. Now, wonderfully, and thankfully, Professor Lawrence Solem, the Dean of Legal Theory, eventually, I think, I wish it had happened sooner, but in the late spring, Larry Solem finally published an essay saying what's happening in the attacks on this scholarship and the birthright citizenship debate have gone too far. These accusations of bad faith actually prevent the truth from emerging in a clash of opposing investigations. I'm glad he did that, but I don't think there's going to be any change. Certainly, there's not going to be any change on Blue Sky. The Blue Sky guys are embarrassed today because they were telling everyone, don't listen to these academics, or they're bad guys, or they're doing this for all kinds of bad reasons, and they end up convincing four justices on the Supreme Court. So all they can do today is talk about how bad those four justices are on the Supreme Court. Blue Sky is not going to change. What has to happen is that academics need to simply stop listening to Blue Sky, and we need to create, even if it has to be a separate ecosystem, there has to be a protected ecosystem of those actually dedicated to developing truth seeking. And for that reason, I really celebrate the development of institutions and institutes at different law schools around the country that are providing that type of protected atmosphere for the development of counter views.
I guess what I would just add in the last minute here in response is a point in defense of academia. Like, I do think more people find these demands for recantation, to be distasteful than find my scholarship or Kurt's scholarship or anyone else's scholarship distasteful, whether they think we're right or wrong. I will say, like, lots of fancy law professors at fancy law school have told me, mostly privately, sometimes in public, that, like, oh yeah, this is obviously not an open and shut question. I wish more of them would say it publicly, but I think that more academics support the inquiry than the types you would find on Blue Sky. The other thing is you just kind of have to tackle it with humor, and good spirits, And so when I was, someone on Blue Sky demanded that I recant my views and there must be repercussions, I tweeted about it. And I said something like, oh yes, let's bring back that traditional tool of academic inquiry, the recantation, it's silly. It should be, we should use, I think, humor to disable it a little bit. But I will say, Something that my podcast co-host, Josh Kleinfeld, professor at George Mason, likes to say, the idea that, you know, why are academic disputes so bitter because so little is at stake? He says that is the silliest aphorism he's ever heard because the stakes are enormous in academia. You look at ideas that were propagated in the 1980s and they're now infecting K through 12 education, right? I mean, academia really does matter and you can see why they get riled up about it because the stakes are actually high, but I think that's all the more reason to come off as a consummate scholar and you know, if the stakes are high, that's not a reason to treat it as one more weapon and institution in the political battles, right? It's all the more reason to treat the academic inquiry seriously. And I, you know, that's really what I try to do.
Yeah. Well, before I hand this off for the true sign off, I just want to say thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion. It's so impressive that you all were able to review all of these thickets of opinions on such kind of short notice. And I know these are issues that we've all been looking at and thinking about for quite some time. And to go back to a question I asked Professor Lash earlier, I think, you know, as Churchill once said, this isn't the end. This is just the end of the beginning. So I think there's a lot more to come and I look forward to reading what you all publish on this. And with that, Alex, I'll pass it back to you.
Thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our panel for sharing their time and expertise with us. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.